Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. The crisis around Tony Abbott's leadership has rather drowned out the fact that federal parliament is back for the year and started work. Conflicting signals are coming from the government this week about whether it will continue to pursue some of the controversial measures from its 2014 budget, which it hasn't been able to get through. Tony Abbott is suggesting that maybe it'll be more pragmatic, but Joe Hockey insists there is no alternative if the budget is eventually to return to surplus. Clive Palmer's pup lost one senator last year when Jackie Lambie became an independent. But with his alliance with the motoring enthusiast party's Ricky Muir, it means that when Muir votes with pup, Palmer still has 3 out of the 6 votes the government needs to pass legislation that's opposed by Labor and the Greens. The head of PUP joins us today. Clive Palmer, have you returned to Canberra in a more conciliatory mood towards any of the government's measures?
Well, I've returned to Canberra with a high resolve to serve the Australian people, to make sure that their interests are well looked after. And I welcomed the move by the Prime Minister that he was going to listen more to the people of Australia before he formulated policy. I was horrified to hear the comments of Joe Hockey saying he was going to cut things further and further, because cuts destroy demand, they'll collapse the economy, and they'll guarantee we never get to surplus.
Well, if we can go first to some of the specifics that are still outstanding. The government's done backflips, a couple of backflips since Parliament was sitting on the Medicare changes. Have you revised your opposition to these at all?
Well, there'll be no co-payment. Michelle will be voting against it.
Some of the changes are regulations, aren't they?
Well, they're trying to do it as a regulation, but any changes that are in regulations will be disallowed by the Senate.
And what about the tougher welfare measures that also ran into opposition last year?
Well, again, there was over $10 billion of cuts to people on unemployment benefits, sickness benefits, the pension, a whole range of issues that we stopped as the sort of the last century of the gate to protect their rights. Our position hasn't changed. It's not about cutting that'll make this country go. We need to grow the economy. We need a forward policy that provides more demand in the economy so it can grow and then government can get more revenue. Now, if you continue to cut everything, you'll destroy demand and you'll just end up with more and more debt and more problems.
One measure that the government is absolutely determined to pursue is its deregulation of universities, which critics say will price degrees out of the range of some people. Are you still adamant that you won't come to the party even on a revised package?
Well, you know, they're wasting a lot of taxpayers' money by continually bringing these bills through the House of Representatives up to the Senate, doing the same thing over and over again. Only an idiot expects to get a different outcome from repeatedly doing the same thing time after time. That's what the government's doing, so we won't be voting in favour of any changes to our education system.
Now, PUP is part of a proposed inquiry into these changes, Senate inquiry. What would you expect such an inquiry to yield?
Well, I think it'll show that the motivation for this is not about improving the system at all. It's an ideological driven one. And it'll also throw up some important issues about education that we can address and we can improve the whole sector.
Do you agree, though, that the universities do face a crisis of funding if they're going to remain competitive and improve Australia's position in education internationally? So what is the answer if
Well, of course, the government is lying to people so much. It's all based on the fact that they say we've got a large debt problem. Well, in point of fact, our debt is only 12% of our GDP, and with only one of 13 countries with a AAA credit rating. When Bob Menzies was Prime Minister, it was 40% of GDP. So it's a manufactured crisis.
So really what you're saying is the government does have the resources to put more money into universities.
Well, of course it does. All these budget measures only come up to about $40 or $50 billion in total. Yet we're a $1.5 trillion economy. It's really just a sideshow.
Have ministers contacted you since you've been back in Canberra about measures that are outstanding?
They have, yeah.
And what... Who and what? Well, over what?
I can't say who, but we haven't yet met with them, so I don't know what their positions will be. I would hope that they would try to get a growth policy for this country so we can create more jobs and a better future for our citizens.
Presumably, Christopher Pine is still trying to persuade you?
Well, I think we've been as clear as we could possibly be without being rude to Christopher that we won't be supporting any deregulation.
I don't think he'd take offence.
I don't think he would, but... We won't be supporting any deregulation in the Senate. We won't be voting for a co-payment.
Are you confident, you lose Jackie Lambie last year, are you confident that you can hold the Muir vote? He's only an alliance, he's not part of
public. Well, Jackie Lambie's already said she won't be voting for education or the co-payment, and so is Nick Xenophon. So we're not alone. And, John Howard said that mathematics is one of the most important thing in politics. It's a shame that the government hasn't been able to learn to count.
Do you think PUP this year will hold firm, that you won't find your two senators diverging from each other on anything?
Nothing, I don't think.
Now, in general terms, you mentioned Joe Hockey and his tough line.
Yep.
He was particularly uncompromising, I think, yesterday on the 7:30 report about what needs to be done for fiscal consolidation.
Mm.
What's your general take on his position?
Well, he's just taking advice from Treasury. He's not able to discriminate between the advice he's given. He doesn't have any other advisors. So Treasury are people that left school 30, 40 years ago, left university, gone to conferences between universities in Sydney and Melbourne, all have the one line, are mainly concerned about ensuring that they keep control of enough money to secure their retirement, their superannuation. They don't really care about the country.
Well, that's a bit harsh, perhaps, on John Fraser, the new head of Treasury, who's had a career in international investment banking. Surely he's seen something of the world.
Well, I don't know. By seeing the world, he'd be better seeing Australia. I've created more billions of dollars of exports for this country. I don't know whether John Fraser's created any exports for this country. And that's what it's about, getting more exports and getting more growth in the real world. An investment banker is only someone that tenders for positions to be your advisors. I've had many investment banks tender to advise me so they could pick up a commission. They're not in the real engine room. They're not really driving what happens. It's industry that does that.
Now, what about Joe Hockey's position? There's been a bit of speculation that he should be replaced by Malcolm Turnbull as Treasurer, that Tony Abbott is under pressure to move him. Do you think he should be moved? Do you think Malcolm Turnbull would be a good Treasurer?
Well, I think Malcolm Turnbull would be a good Treasurer. I think Joe Hockey could be a good Treasurer. It's not about the individuals in these positions. It's about the policies that they're pursuing. And certainly if we are going to pursue the cuts, as I said, you'll destroy demand, you'll collapse the Australian economy within the next 6 months, and we'll be in a real recession situation heading for a depression. We don't want to go the way of Greece. Joe Hockey talks about balancing the budget, but the United States hasn't balanced its budget only 12 times in 50 years. Uzbekistan and Ghana have a balanced budget. I don't know if Joe's following the Uzbekistani model or the Ghanaese model, but we really need to follow the United States, where President Obama has introduced stimulus, Europe's introduced stimulus, and their economies are turning around while we're further declining.
So if you were in Tony Abbott's position, would you move Joe Hockey or leave him where he is?
Well, I'd bring everyone together and say we got it wrong. We need to make a fundamental change. The political conditions are different to what our policy is. Campbell Newman's shown what an arrogant approach leads to. And if we want to stay in government, we've got to provide policies that will create growth and prosperity for the Australian people.
Well, the Liberals had a vote, of course, on the leadership this week. They rejected a spill, but the vote was quite narrow. Do you think that Tony Abbott can regroup, or do you think that we're seeing the beginning of a classic two-stage removal process?
Well, I think that there's no time to waste. He's got to implement change quickly and got to give some clear definitions that what Joe Hockey said this morning won't happen. Because if it's more of the same, he can expect to go.
One of the criticisms has been about his office. Now, I noticed that you recently have actually defended his controversial Chief of Staff, Peter Credlin, who's criticised as being too controlling. Wouldn't it be better for Tony Abbott's prospects if he did, in fact, revamp his office?
Well, every Member of Parliament knows they control their own staff. Anything Ms. Cretlin's done, it's only been at the behest of the person that employs Tony Abbott. So I think he's got to accept the responsibility for whatever she's done. I don't think it's fair to pick on yourself.
Even if he does try to change a whole lot of things, given his long-term unpopularity in the polls, do you think he can get the coalition back to what looks like a competitive polling position?
Well, I don't think he can personally. It's what the party stands for, what policies he's got that may be able to, right? But we know for sure that whoever leads the Liberal Party, whether it's Malcolm Turnbull or whether it's Tony Abbott, if they pursue the policies they've currently pursued, they're doomed.
But even if they change policies, can he, given that unpopularity, revive?
Well, I think people will respond to good policy. People respond to growth and their lives getting better. And that's what makes people vote. I mean, that's why we got into Parliament, because we based our campaign not on individuals but on policy. And I think policy is what changes minds. So we know that John Howard was able to do it, where he was further down the polls, more unpopular than Tony Abbott. He was able to come back and win an election. So it can be done, but there's no time to mess about. There's no time to think there's going to be another chance. This is it. You either get on with it or you don't.
Now, you're something of a mate with Malcolm Turnbull, the odd Chinese dinner and so on. If the Liberals did install Malcolm Turnbull, do you think their fortunes would be better?
Well, what would happen if they changed leader probably is that for eight weeks you'd have a revival of the polls of the Liberal Party. And if the policies weren't changed, they would decline again. That's what happened with Kevin Rudd. You're sure he came back for the honeymoon period for 4 or 6 weeks. They didn't have any policies to offer the Australian public, so they declined. So at the end of the day, you've got to make the hard decisions and do what's right.
So what sort of a leader do you think Turnbull would be?
Well, I think he's a very capable person. He demonstrates that in Parliament. And he's a very loyal person. He's been very loyal to the Prime Minister. And so I think they've really got a pretty good front bench, the government, which is underutilised, because it's got trying to push bad ideas.
Do you think Turnbull would be inclined to change policy?
Well, it's a matter for the party to change policy. The party should take responsibility, not the leaders. The leaders could put up ideas, but the party should be voting on the way they're going. The focus has all been on leadership. There was a time in the Liberal Party, the coalition room, where people actually discussed proposals.
That must have been a very long time ago.
Well, back in the 60s and 70s, they used to do that. They actually need to get back to thinking, talking about ideas. That's what needs to happen.
Well, we have seen the backbench assert itself this week. We've seen this revolt really driven by the backbench, saying they want to be consulted more, they want to have more input.
Well, everything should come from the party room. You've got representatives across Australia that listen to the community, know what they want, and all proposals should be discussed in the party room. At least the party members should be given the chance to comment on them, because you benefit from that wisdom. You know, there's so much wisdom in the government's party room and in the Labor Party's party room, but you need to give everyone a chance to contribute what they can. They may not always be right. I'm not always right. I'm wrong a lot of times. But everyone should have the right to say it, because they represent parts of the Australian people.
Well, it's a balance, isn't it? Because while it's important that the voice of the electorate comes up through these representatives, on the other hand, leaders have to lead, especially in areas where the decisions will be unpopular.
Well, leaders have to make judgments about what they can achieve politically, realistically. Now, if a leader says that these policies are what I believe should happen, but he can't achieve that politically, he's made a false judgment. So you've got to have a balance, if you're a leader, a responsible balance, to say, I'm only going to move the public with me as far as I can go. If I go beyond that precipice, I'm courting disaster.
Let's just turn to the Queensland election. The result there was rather bittersweet for you, I guess, because Campbell Newman, whom you've strongly opposed, is gone. But on the other hand, didn't achieve any seats.
Well, actually, it was a pretty good result for us, we thought, because we didn't give out how-to-vote cards with our candidates' names on them, and we only stood in half the seats. The seats we did stand, we got a 9% vote, and we think that that was much higher if we'd given out how-to-vote cards, and we'd get another senator in the next Senate. So we're pretty happy with that. And, of course, our vote expired in a number of seats, which changed the government. So it was goodbye Campbell Newman, opened the bottle of champagne that night.
Well, you did tell me before the election that you thought you would win seats and hold the balance of power.
Well, that would have happened if in John Bjelke-Petersen, where he stood in Callide against the Deputy Premier, his vote, together with the Labor and Green vote, outpolled the Deputy Premier. The problem with their voting system was that some of the preferences expired, they weren't passed through. So we did, in effect, get the majority of people in Callide, which was a 70% LNP seat, voting against the Premier. So that was a moral victory for us. John got 26% first preferences, and that was a pretty good vote for us. So we were pretty happy with that result. Under the federal electoral system, we would have won the seat.
How come you didn't hand out how-to-vote cards?
Well, I was having a holiday with my family in New Caledonia, and they just printed Vote 1 Palmer United, rather than saying Vote 1 John Bjelke-Petersen for Callide, for example. So there was a lot of confusion at the polls. A lot of people came out and said that they didn't know how to vote for us. So I think our real vote would have been another 4 or 5% higher if we'd identified the candidate on the cards.
It was an important election for you. Why were you away?
Because I've got a wife and two children that are also very important to me, and I promised them I'd take them on a holiday. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why Campbell Newman called the election. Most of the electorate was on holidays.
Your holiday or
my
try
holiday,
to.
Or everyone's holiday. If he was going to go, he wanted to make it as most inconvenient for everyone.
Now, there's going to be a by-election in one seat.
Well, there might be. There may not be. You know, it's up to the Court of Disputed Returns to decide.
Right. If there is a by-election, which will have been caused by the fact that the PUP candidate was an undischarged
bankrupt.
Which would be caused by the fact that the PUP candidate was an undischarged bankrupt. Will you run a candidate?
Yeah, we will. We think the people of Ferny-Grove have got a right to know and a right to express their opinion. I have to apologise to everyone in Ferny-Grove. This particular candidate signed a declaration that he wasn't an undischarged bankrupt, and we accepted that, and we found out later on he was. And that's a great disappointment, because it means it incurs public expense and inconvenience.
How do you think a by-election would go?
Well, I personally think the Labor Party would probably win it, and there'd be no change.
Clive Palmer, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast today. That's all for today. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. I'm Michelle Grattan. We'll be back with another interview soon.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.